next week, so I hope you can join me again, all from the usual time of 9 o'clock. Our Easter seasonal journey has been a tandem production for BBC Radio 3. Well, it's midday and time now for the news, read by Jane Royce.
Ukraine's President Zelensky says Russia is continuing to shell parts of the front line, despite President Putin declaring a pause in hostilities until the end of today. Ukraine said earlier it would adhere to the brief ceasefire and mirror Russia's actions. Moscow accused Ukraine of drone attacks last night. Mr. Zelensky has reiterated Ukraine's willingness to begin a 30-day unconditional truce, something Russia has not agreed to despite pressure from Washington. The Pope has delivered a short Easter message to crowds in St. Peter's Square in Rome, despite his recent ill health. He spent 5 weeks in hospital being treated for pneumonia. There were cheers as the Pope, who's 88, appeared in his wheelchair on the balcony of St. Peter's Basilica to wish everyone a happy Easter.
Sorelle, buona Pasqua.
The Cardinal then delivered the traditional Urbi et Orbi message on the Pope's behalf. The Vatican's confirmed that the US Vice President J.D. Vance had a meeting with the Pope this morning. Mr. Vance converted to Catholicism 6 years ago. The Pope has been critical of some of the Trump administration's policies. Here, the Easter sermon, traditionally given by the Archbishop of Canterbury, is being delivered by the Archbishop of York after Justin Welby's resignation last November. His duties have been delegated to Dr. Stephen Cottrell, who's addressing the congregation at York Minster. The King and Queen were welcomed by crowds as they joined at Windsor Castle for the Easter service. They were joined by other members of the royal family, including the Duke of York. One of Britain's most accomplished cyclists, Barry Hoban, has died. He was 85. Barry Hoban won 8 stages of the Tour de France between 1967 and 1975, a record for a British rider that stood until 2009, when it was beaten by Mark Cavendish. And the weather, a mostly dry day across the UK with sunny spells and some patchy cloud. There's a chance of a shower later in Northern Ireland and in southeast England. BBC News at 12:02. Now it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Romola Garai won her first professional acting roles as a teenager, and since then her career has taken her in a wide range of dramatic directions. On stage, she's played Cordelia opposite Ian McKellen's King Lear, and this year she received 2 Olivier Award nominations, competing against herself. There for her roles in Giant, a play about Roald Dahl, and The Years, a play based on the novel by Nobel Prize winner Annie Ernaux. Among many, many film and television roles, she's played the title part in a BBC adaptation of Jane Austen's Emma and won acclaim for The Hour, a drama set behind the scenes of a TV current affairs programme in the 1950s. In 2020, she went behind the camera to write and direct a horror film called Amulet, and frightening it indeed is. Is music very important in your life, quite apart from its use in drama?
It is important in my life, yes. I listen to a lot of music, a lot of different kinds of music, but also it's a very important part of my creativity because I listen to a lot of music when I'm writing. And so I think that there's a sort of wellspring that I draw from, which is different kinds of music.
Well, you've brought John Tavener, Michael Nyman, Keith Jarrett, amongst others, but you're going to begin with Avo Pärt?
Yes, I was introduced to Avo Pärt sort of in my mid-20s. When I started working with filmmakers, often directors would use temp scores, and I really fell in love with his work as a composer. But I also particularly chose this piece because it's choral, and I sung a lot in a choir when I was at school, and it was one of the happiest times of my life, singing with other people. And I think that it's very difficult these days for people to understand what the kind of raw expression of creativity is. It's being with other people, telling stories and making music. because I do it as a job, I think very fondly back to that time where it was nothing to do with making money or having success. It's just something beautiful that you do with other people.
Thank you.
Were you singing soprano or alto?
I was the soprano, and I think when I listened to that piece of music, it really takes me back to the joy of the experience when I was young of that playful interaction between your role as a soprano to kind of float above those richer notes underneath. It was, yeah, it's a beautiful piece of music. I really love it.
Tell me, Romola Garai, a little bit about your childhood. You were born in Hong Kong and also lived in Singapore, but I don't suppose that's where your name came from.
No. So it was an accident that I was born there. My dad was a bank manager for, as was Lloyd's TSB. And at that time, they had branches in Asia. And so he took his young family, my older brother and sister and my mum, out there. And they initially lived in Korea and then Hong Kong and Singapore briefly, which is where I was born. But quite soon after that, Lloyd's Bank started to shut its branches in Asia. And so we came back to the UK. And we, because of his job, landed up in Wilkes, which was a place that my parents didn't have any connection to. And I was about six when we moved there. And I spent my childhood living in the countryside there. Or, well, we lived in a town, but surrounded by a sort of beautiful countryside. But, you know, I'm very close to my siblings. I'm one of four.
Garai sounds vaguely Hungarian.
Yeah, so my dad's grandfather emigrated from Hungary to New York in the 1920s, where he and his brothers set up a company called the Keystone Press Agency. They were in picture publishing. And then he moved to London, married an English woman, and my dad's parents were doctors in Surrey. And so that kind of connection with Hungary and the wider family was lost. And I was brought up pronouncing my name Gary, a very English sort of anglicisation of my name.
So your family moved back to Wiltshire, and I wondered what kind of music you heard in your childhood.
So my parents had a lot of vinyl, Elvis and, you know, the music of their teenage years, classical music as well. But because my parents were older when I was born, it did always feel like there was quite a big gap between my tastes. And my parents were, you know, are, their marriage is very successful and they tend to share a lot of the same tastes. But my siblings and I were essentially left to our own devices a lot. And we were very close. So my musical tastes were very influenced by my siblings. So when my elder sister got into dance music, or my younger sister got really into listening to indie music like Belle and Sebastian, those were the kind of influences that...
So is this... This next piece, does this come from your siblings?
Yeah, so I hung around a lot with my sisters when I was young. My older sister's a bit older than me, so she got a driving license and she would take us out at the weekend. And she took me and my younger sister to see Little Women, the version that was made in 1994 with Winona Ryder and Susan Sarandon in it. And it had a huge effect on me. It's an incredibly beautiful film. And it's a film about being a sibling, the beauty of those relationships, and Thomas Newman's music, which won an Oscar, it also started a sort of love affair for me with American folk music and Americana, which is something that has been a big love of mine through my life. And I actually can't listen to this piece of music without crying. It just really makes me think about my sister. So we'll see how I do.
Okay.
Sorry, it always makes me cry. It takes me back to a very happy moment in my life where I saw a film that I completely fell in love with people that I love so much.
Some music works against film deliberately, but that was clearly a piece with that clarinet melody that got into the essence of the film for you?
Yeah, I think the film opens with that piece of music and it's used throughout the film. And a lot of my taste in film is extremely dark and weird.
Yes, we'll come on to that
later. But that film and its kind of effect on me is just a complete balm and, you know, a reminder of the kind of transcendent power of love and family, and the movement of the music is the spiritual aspect of family.
Little Women by Thomas Newman, performed by the London Symphony Orchestra. When did you actually first sort of catch the acting bug, Robert?
So I wasn't very good at anything at school. Academically, I was not particularly bright and I had absolutely no sporting ability at all. But I loved reading and I loved stories, all kinds of stories. I was in a speech and drama club and then I was lucky enough my parents would take me to speech and drama lessons, my younger sister and I. So then we did the Lambda grades where you learn first speaking and a lot of acting on your own, just solo acting. But my teacher told my mum that she thought I had talent, and given that I hadn't really shown talent in any other area, I think that was a great relief for my parents, who struggled very, very hard to put us through private school. You know, my mum didn't go to private school. It was a real effort for my family. It was the singular effort of my family. The sort of goal was to put us through private school in order for us to kind of return on that investment. And I think I felt very stressed as a child that I hadn't been able to do that. So I tried to fulfil their ambitions. Initially, I auditioned for the National Youth Theatre and I got in, and I was very young when I got in. I was only 14. And then my mum really doubled down on that, and she applied for a place at City of London School for Girls, which had a bursary for people who showed promise in acting. And I got that, even though academically I would never have got into the school otherwise. But I had to move to London on my own in order to go to that school. So I was essentially independent, living in London from the age of 16. And then quite soon after that, I started getting professional work. So my life as an actor started when I was really young. And I'm not sure that I really did choose to be an actor. I think I felt like it was kind of my duty to to sort of try and repay my parents to some extent, which I think has always kind of made my relationship with it a bit not confused, really, because I do love it. And it's not something I've ever chosen to give up. But it wasn't something that I pursued necessarily.
What do you think National Youth Theatre taught you?
Well, most of the people that I went to do this course with were quite a bit older than me. So I would have to say the main thing it taught me was to pretend that I was a grown up when I wasn't. I think I was mimicking being an adult at a very young age. And I think it's only now, as I'm a mother myself, that I appreciate, like a lot of people who are kind of thrust into the adult world quite young, how much performance goes into that. I mean, I was acting on stage and off, as it were. You know, I was really pretending to understand people's jokes and what was going on, the sort of machinations of older teenagers when I was barely out of childhood, and I had a very protected childhood. So yes, a lot of performance.
And were there particular films at that time that made an impression on you?
Yeah, so I was a child of the 90s, and so we had a Blockbuster video card, and I did fall in love with film in a big way. But the films that really blew my mind at that time were, I saw Sally Potter's Orlando when I was probably about 13, and that became my sort of favourite film. And that film led me on to the work of Peter Greenaway and Derek Jarman. And, you know, I've spent the last sort of few years trying to write a film which is a sort of homage to those films.
In fact, that Peter Greenaway, Michael Nyman world is where we're going next.
Yes, so Prospero's Magic from Prospero's Books by Michael Nyman is one of my favourite pieces of music and reminds me of the extraordinary power of filmmaking to be pure beauty, pure escapism, and the sort of non-narrative aspects of that film, you know, the aesthetics of that film, the music and imagery is what really excites me. And recently I was playing the piece of music at home and my children, who are 8 and 12, turned their heads towards me and were so amazed by this piece of music, and they wanted to know where it came from, and they're into sort of fantasy, dragons and Lord of the Rings and things like that. And I think there's something about the music that just expands your internal imagination so much. They wanted to know what the music was recalling in terms of the film, and I said, I think you can just think of anything when you're listening to it.
Thank you.
love that piece of music so much. It really started a great love affair with Shakespeare for me, and I've been lucky enough to perform in a few Shakespeare plays, and I think that that piece of music for me just so encapsulates what I love about The Tempest as well, the sea and magic and power. Yeah, it's just an extraordinary piece of music.
One common denominator that I've noticed in your list, speaks the psychoanalyst, is the use of repetition in Arvo Pärt, in that piece certainly, later John Tavener. Does that make sense to you, that that's something that you particularly like?
Yeah, I think that they aren't questioning pieces of music. They're accelerating pieces of music. I think I'm deeply emotional. For me, music and these pieces of music are very much about reaching a kind of state of like transcendence, you know, and escapism. Like, art for me was always about escapism, being taken away from your emotional state, that you're sort of taken over by that sense of acceleration and growth rather than something that feels more introspective, which I think is very true for me. And a lot of my writing tends to rely on genre, which again is sort of fantastical.
We heard Prospero's Magic from Prospero's Books by Michael Nyman, performed by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra with the pianist Peter Lawson, conducted by Jonathan Carney. I think it was while you were in the sixth form, Romola Garai, that you landed your first part in a TV film, The Last of the Blonde Bombshells, starring alongside Judi Dench.
Well, I think starring alongside would be... definitely what I'd put on my CV. I'm not sure that's completely right. So there were flashbacks in this TV film, and they had to find someone to play her character in these flashbacks.
Judi Dench played a recently widowed woman who's trying to reunite her World War II swing band.
So yes, I had to look like I could play the saxophone, and I've been bluffing my way through life, winging it ever since. But, you know, before I knew it, really, I was on a film set, which is... no one I'd ever known when I was growing up was in the arts at all. I didn't know any actors or writers. I'd never met anyone involved in the industry at all. So it was a huge shock to me. And I meet people now who said, oh, you look like you were taking it all in your stride. But everything about it was strange and unusual. And I didn't have any real sense of it being a career. I thought it was a strange and unusual thing that was happening to me. I mean, I had to have an agent in order to sign the contract to do the film. I was very surprised when that woman called me again to ask me if I wanted to audition for some other films. I had no real sense of it becoming a career. And then it took on its own momentum and I had to sort of go with it.
The creator of our next track wrote, I have courted the fire for a very long time and many sparks have flown in the past. But the music on this recording speaks, finally, the language of the flame itself. Who wrote that and why does it speak to you?
So this is Keith Jarrett, the Vienna concert. So I remember very clearly the first time I heard this piece of music. I was probably only about 19 and I had a boyfriend who was quite a bit older than me and he was a lawyer and he had a flat in London and I was only out of school, but I was sort of pretending to be an adult and pretending to be sophisticated and going out for dinners and being at dinner parties. And really that whole period of my life was characterized by this kind of massive act of performance. But this piece of music is a very beautiful piece of music. And I think it was the beginning of me really being educated about a lot of artistic things that became very important to me by people who were older than me. And also a lot about... it makes me think about the love affairs I had about that at that time of my life, which I've been very happily married for a long time, so it's a fond memory.
Thank you.
Music from part one of the Vienna Concert by Keith Jarrett, recorded on July the 13th, 1991, at the Vienna State Opera. I'm rather fascinated, Romola Garai, that it was at that point in your life where you were beginning to come to terms with being a real person that you've chosen something that was actually more introspective.
Yeah, I think it's an incredibly romantic piece of music. It's very sad as well. And I think, you know, I was living alone. I was working all around the world, as you do when you're lucky enough to be an actor who is in work a lot. And I was quite young. And I think the sadness of the piece may be connected with me at that time in my life.
Your first major film role was in an adaptation of Charles Dickens's Nicholas Nickleby.
Yeah, that shoot and being on a big film with an entire set filled with extras and carts and Victoria in London and everything that being, you know, in a big movie entails was, yeah, wonderful.
It was the first of many costume dramas because you also starred in Vanity Fair, Atonement, and later Emma for the BBC. I'm interested in what draws you to playing women from a different era, which is like one more removed from being yourself.
Yeah, I mean, Atonement was an extraordinary experience for me because I was cast very late in the day. So I only had about a week, I think, before I was due on set and usually have more time to prepare. But I knew the novel, I'd read the novel, and I'd actually had a very strong feeling about the character visually when I read the novel. So that was helpful to me when they called up and said, will you play the part? I knew who she was, Bryony, and I think there was something about her being a young person, a young woman, but trapped in this moment from her childhood. And it was a wonderful experience. And I think that the idea of atonement and how you make up for the sins of your past is something that I felt a strong connection with the themes of the piece.
Alongside your first roles, you also went back to university.
Yeah, I think I realised when working a lot as an actor that, you know, you were going to be travelling all the time and also constantly making connections with people then get broken. I did stop to think, is this the life that I want? This wasn't really chosen by me. I never really pursued any of these things myself. So I realised I had absolutely no other options. So I went back to university and finished my degree with just the goal of giving myself more choice. But by the time I had finished my degree, I had started writing. And that's when I realised I could be truly fulfilled as an actor, having the opportunity to express my kind of creativity in other ways through writing and then eventually directing.
Well, Handel next. Now, why do you like this?
I have written and have been trying to make for a few years a film which is all set in the court of Charles II. So I was very steeped in the Baroque architecture and political ideas of that time, and of course the music. So I wrote this film, which I'm still trying to make, called Monstrous Beauty, to a playlist, which obviously Handel featured very strongly in that. But the music that inspires you to write a film is always very important to you because it flows into your own creativity. So I'm very grateful to this piece of music for giving me that screenplay.
Dancing Away, the minuet from the Water Suite No. 2 in D major by Handel, performed by Collegium Aureum. Romola Garai, you talked in the past about the profound misogyny you faced on set as a young actor. In 2004, you appeared in the Dirty Dancing sequel, Havana Nights, and I think you had some very uncomfortable experiences then.
Yes, I did, yeah. I was terrifically unprepared for what the expectations around being a young actress were. And so I was involved in lots of experiences when I started out where there was an understanding that you would pretty much do anything in order to secure roles and that you were very comfortable to be, you know, objectified. And I'd never really thought very much about my physical body. I had always been lucky enough to be accepted as an individual, and I felt very conflicted about that.
So this wouldn't be just sexual advances, but actually talk about what you look like and your body.
Yeah, and I suppose what your job as a woman in film is your job as a woman on screen to control other women? Are you there to perpetrate ideas that control the way other women, women watching you, think about themselves? And I was just very uncomfortable with that. And I think when you drill down into the statistics of filmmaking, who makes films, who writes them, who commissions them, it was then, as it was in the past, and it is now still primarily an industry run by men. So you cannot take that away until you have equal representation, you know, with women behind the camera in all variety of roles. You're always going to have a very complicated dynamic between the stories that you tell and particularly the female audience that you're reaching out to.
And I think initially you felt complicit for not fighting back against some of this.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was probably very hard on myself. I now look back and I think you were, you know, 19, 20, 21-year-old woman. Why on earth would you feel guilty about not having fought back against a billion-dollar industry that was controlling you? But, you know, I think like a lot of women, you internalise a lot of feelings of guilt around your complicity with a misogynistic system. And now that I'm older, I understand, of course, that, you know, any way that you push back against that system is a minor triumph. And also, you know, it's very easy to make women feel guilty as a way of controlling them even further.
Since then, you've obviously been very careful to pick roles that you feel comfortable with. In 2007, you starred in the film Angel, directed by François Ozon, considered one of the most important French directors. What do you feel you got from working with Ozon?
Yeah, so when I started off as an actor, I understood that it was a job and that I was getting paid to do pretending. And the whole concept of art, of it being something you would do because you were a creative person to make art, was just completely foreign. I think I had a very English background where art and all pretensions to be an artist was slightly frowned upon. You know, it was seen as bourgeois and frivolous. And so to work with a French director steeped in the history of French cinema, who thought that the making of a film was an expression of an idea that connects you to other people, that's inherent in human beings. And, you know, the beauty of the way that he talked about film and about the film that we were making had a huge effect on me. I was very lucky to work with him.
Well, it was mutual because he described you as his muse on that film. It was inspired by the story of Marie Corelli, wasn't it? Queen Victoria's favourite writer.
Yes, and adapted by the novel by the British writer Elizabeth Taylor. So it is a film, a strange film, about an artist and about an artist wanting total artistic control and about how that interacts with commerce, essentially, the great kind of artistic conundrum.
John Tavener next. I mean, he is someone we think of slightly in the same breadth as Arvo Pärt, because both of them used to write quite complex avant-garde music and then turned back to a sort of spiritual simplicity, if you like. What informed your choice here?
I've always loved this piece of music. I'm not a religious person. I grew up in an atheist wasteland. We didn't attend any kind of place of worship. We never really talked about God. You know, I had a very secular upbringing. But I think in another time, in another place, I think I would have been a religious person. And I think this kind of music, this spiritual music, really profoundly affects me. And I suppose the closest that I come to a kind of worship is the experience of storytelling with other artists. I've always been very much passionately moved by the idea that art is meant to change things. It's meant to tell stories that affect the world in a positive way, which is probably not a very fashionable idea these days. But that sense of the human experience needing to be one of evolving towards something better.
And the solo cello is rather like the human voice, isn't it?
It's a plea, it's a prayer. It sounds like a human being in conversation with God.
The Protecting Veil by John Tavener, performed by Lionel Martin with the Stuttgarter Kammerorchester, directed by Corinna Niemeyer. Listening to that music, do you get a kind of feeling of sorrow, longing?
I think it's longing, yes. It's a longing for the kind of profound connection that many people in the world have with eternal beauty and a hope for humanity. And I think, you know, I obviously am 42, you know, I'm not living in the crucible of this, but particularly for younger generations, we've created a world where people aren't supposed to believe in anything or see any future for themselves at all. And I think that longing is really profound, a profound human need. And I love to listen to that piece of music to remind me of how appropriate it is that you should have that longing.
Romola Garay, in 2012, you directed your first short film called Scrubber. How did you come to get behind the camera?
From the sort of middle of my 20s, I started writing and I knew that I wanted to direct films, and making a short is obviously the first step on that road. So, yeah, I made my first short when I was 29 and, you know, I was very lucky. It did well. It was nominated for an award at Sundance and lots of other festivals. It's a short film which is about a young woman who's trying to get someone to look after her child so that she can have a sexual assignation, and what it means to have different roles in your life. I hadn't had children at that point. You know, I have two kids now, but perhaps I think I felt quite divided already about what was expected of me as a woman in different situations.
And then in 2020, you directed your first full-length film, Amulet, starring Imelda Staunton. Just give us an idea of the story there.
So Amulet is a horror film about a man who has come from an unnamed European country. He's played by a Romanian actor, but we never voice where he's from. He is down and out in London, and through a sort of chance encounter with a nun, he gets a job, essentially working in a house with a young woman who's caring for her elderly mother, who's in a room upstairs. But very quickly, you start to realise that potentially it's not her elderly mother upstairs in the house, that it's perhaps some sort of supernatural entity. But about halfway through the film, you start to realise that everything you understand about all three of the characters is all switched around. So it's very questioning of people's roles and playful with that, and hopefully very scary.
It is. It's frightening. Another wonderful film score next. This is Aguirre, The Wrath of God, directed by Werner Herzog.
So this is, I think, one of the greatest pieces of music ever composed for film. Werner Herzog had a very long-standing relationship with Popolvoor and they composed for a number of different films. I think it's a transcendently brilliant piece of music. The film is one of the greatest films ever made, but it is so enhanced by the score. I don't think that this film really lives in any meaningful way outside of the music. Also, I don't really feel like I'm from anywhere. You know, I was born in a country that I almost immediately left. I was brought up in a place that no one in my family had any connection to. My father's family were Hungarian Jewish immigrants. I don't feel like I'm from anywhere. And I think this film is really about the kind of raw domination that exists in the dark heart of human beings and how they conquer other nations and other countries. And the concept of nationhood and statehood is such a strange one.
Thank you. Aguirre by Popol Vuh. Popol Vuh was a German musical collective founded by the keyboardist Florian Fricker. They did a number of collaborations with Herzog, including Nosferatu and Fitzcarraldo. And that has inspired many other people. For example, Kate Bush took the opening of Nosferatu for Hello Earth on her Hounds of Love album. So it's interesting the way these things cascade down and influence other people.
Yeah, and you know, Werner Herzog's films have had such a profound influence on so many filmmakers. He's a, you know, obviously a titan.
Romola, in 2023, you played Doreen Warriner in One Life. That was the film about Nicholas Winton, extraordinary man, who rescued over 600 children from Nazi-occupied Czechoslovakia. Doreen was one of the English women working there. This must have been very fascinating for you because it touches on your own family's history.
Yeah, so I'd not heard of Doreen Warriner. I was familiar with the clip from That's Life of Esther Ranson introducing the children who were rescued by Nicholas Winton, who all stand up around him in the studio audience. But, you know, to my shame and embarrassment, I didn't know the sort of wider story, and the British Committee for Refugees in Czechoslovakia was run by her. So when he got to Czechoslovakia, it was her organisation. She was running that. She was an incredible woman. She was a agricultural economist, which is a very unusual thing for a woman to be at any time, but particularly at that time. She had languages and she had dropped her day job, as it were, in order to organise this refugee mission. And I think that the foresight of those people, their ability to understand that there was going to be these mass murders, that there was just a human imperative to do something, even if that thing was to just to save the children, is really an extraordinary and humbling action. And as you say, because my father's family, my great-grandfather's sisters and his parents were murdered in the Holocaust in Hungary, so I feel a strong connection with that story.
So what is the next piece of music?
This is one of, I think, probably my favourite piece of folk music. It's Am I Born to Die? Another cheerful number for me. But again, it's a deeply spiritual piece of music. And the exaltation at death and the transcendence of that is something that when you live a particularly modern life and our relationship to our bodies is so broken down by technology, I find the way that this song talks about the corporeal experience is very profound. And as I say, it's folk music, it's Americana, it's the Appalachian music, which I've always had a real love for. So it's one of my favourite songs.
The dread
such a profound piece of, the lyrics of it are so incredible.
I always love musical performances, especially of folk music, where there's that kind of dirt in the voice. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. Something
absolutely gravelly and of the earth.
Yeah.
Am I Born to Die, a traditional tune performed by Tim Erickson for the film Cold Mountain. Romola Garai, alongside your work in television and film, you have, of course, played some wonderful stage roles. And this year, you were nominated for Best Supporting Actress for two theatre roles at the Olivier Awards. One was Giant, about the author Roald Dahl. The other role was in The Years by Annie Ernaux, following the life of a French woman from the end of the Second World War till the dawn of the digital age. She is played by five actors. I think you play number three.
I am Annie Three, or was Annie Three, yeah.
It caused quite a bit of, well, actually distress sometimes, didn't it? Because it's no holds barred stuff.
Yeah, in the middle of the play, Annie Three has a monologue where she describes an illegal abortion that she went through in 1964 when she was a student at university in Rouen in Paris. Unfortunately, I think it's a pretty typical experience of women accessing an abortion then and now illegally. And it's a very, I don't know, there's something about the word graphic I don't like because it suggests a sort of degree of pleasure taken in it, which I think is true. It's just a very accurate depiction of that experience. And yeah, we had people faint almost every single time that we did it. We had
well,
to stop
the
show.
Well, you were covered in blood, weren't you?
I did. There was some fake blood. It's not that much. I mean, just to be fair, I've seen productions of Coriolanus with a lot more fake blood than that. I mean, almost any Shakespeare play, there's loads more fake blood than that. But there was a little bit of blood. But I mean, I can say really and truly, it wasn't the blood because we had nights where I got the amount of blood wrong and there wasn't very much and people still fainted. It was the description. It's the language.
Was it difficult to stay in character while this was happening in front of you?
Initially, yes, because the director had said to me when we were preparing the speech, in Holland, people fainted. And I'm afraid I was very poo-pooed that. And I said, well, that's not going to happen here because we have Shakespeare and we do the Greek plays. And, you know, no one's going to faint, you know. So it turns out I was wrong. And the very first time we did it, people sort of fell over into the aisles. And I was completely shocked. And we had no policy for that. I didn't know what to do. And I was sort of standing on the stage, kind of coming up from a dream, as you do sometimes when you're right in the middle of performance. But then obviously we understood that that was something that was going to happen every show. So we all just walked to the side of the stage. And then, yeah, it's not easy to break a performance halfway through, but it just became part of it.
Music was also an important part because the actors broke into song. And
yes, because it spans this big period of time, the play, it's the sort of late second half of the 20th century's history told through French popular music.
Well, it's interesting you say that because the next piece by Alexander Balanescu was inspired by somebody who was known as the Romanian Edith Piaf.
Oh, really? Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, Maria Tanase. Where did you encounter it?
So I heard this piece of music watching the Pina Bausch Company performing Volmond. I love dance. And I always slightly struggle with violin music because my parents really wanted me to play the violin and I was incredibly bad at it. And I think that that really takes me back to that experience of being a bit of a disappointment as a child whenever I hear violin music. But I managed to kind of get through this. And this is a piece of music that I play and listen to a lot. I write a lot when I'm listening to this piece of music. So it takes me to my happy place in my office with my ideas. Thank you.
aria from the Balanescu Quartet and Alexander Balanescu's album, Maria T. Do your children dance?
My son, yeah, he does ballet, and I'm desperately trying not to sort of loom over my children in the way that I feel like I was slightly loomed over by my parents, kind of looking for some sign of talent. But I love to watch him dance, and one of the great pleasures of my life, because I love ballet, is having, yeah, a child who shares that love.
Your husband, Sam Hoare, is also an actor. And I wonder how you find, A, the balance of two actors in the house, and B, how do you balance acting with being a mum?
Well, I think I feel very lucky to be married to another actor. I love it. We're just constantly chatting all the time about what we do and our shared passion for it, theatre, film and literature and books as well. And also there's just the real understanding there of what an incredibly difficult job it is. I use that word advisedly. Obviously, we're not doing anything physically difficult, but the fact that you can go months without work, your career can end at any moment, the industry can just decide it's had enough of you, the sort of psychological aspects of the job, which are really difficult. I feel like I have a real sort of teammate there, and I've really enjoyed being married to another actor. And I think our children are utterly repulsed by the industry now, which is only a good thing. Having two parents constantly talking about their audition tapes and whether they're not they're good at accents is enough to turn anybody off.
Are there any lights at the end of the directing tunnels?
I'm still trying to make a lot of films. I think my films are quite formally ambitious often, and I write films that deal with some very complex themes. And I think that bigger budget films, the audience and the money to make them, is it's very, very difficult to achieve that, particularly at the moment when we have largely lost a lot of our audience for film, because we've either lost it to longer form television or to extreme short form, with younger people just watching videos that are 5 or 6 minutes long. And I think that there is a massive risk of us just losing film as a form in terms of its length entirely, because we just haven't invested enough in it. And also the British film industry and just the number of independent films that are made in this country has just dropped so much that I think a massive part of our cultural identity is really at risk of being completely eradicated in my lifetime, which is something that really concerns me and causes me a lot of pain, because I love films so much. So I think we're going back to a state where, you know, really, if you want to make films, you have to make them for a very low budget, and you have to make them, you know, with smaller casts. But great art has come from those limitations. So, you know, watch this space, I suppose.
And I can't help wondering if there are any roles, either on stage or screen, that you would absolutely love to still do.
Well, I always had a real passion to play Lady M. I suppose it's the traditional role that women really long to play. But, you know, for me, that play was always a love story. It's a story of two people who love each other so much that they're prepared to do anything to advance each other. And I always feel that's slightly lacking in my readings of the play, where she's sort of power hungry in a way that kind of obscures the reason why she's doing what she's doing. So I'd love to have a crack at that.
How are we going to end this programme musically?
I've chosen another piece of traditional music, The Lakes of Pontchartrain, and Paul Brady and his Lost Tapes, which this is taken from, is one of my favourite pieces of folk music. That album is really beautiful. I love his voice so much, and I'm happy to say that it makes me think about my husband and the great good fortune of finding a stranger in the journey of your life that brings you home.
Well, on that happy note, Romola Garay, thank you very much for your private passion.
Thank you for having me.
'Twas on one bright March morning, I bid New Orleans adieu, and I took the road to Jackson Town, my fortune to renew. I cursed all foreign money, no credit could I gain, which filled me heart with longing for the lakes of Pontchartrain. I stepped on board of a railroad I said, me pretty greedy old girl, me money is no good. And if it weren't for the alligators, I'd sleep out in the woods. You're welcome here, kind stranger. Our house is very plain, and we never turn the stranger out on the vine. I asked her if she'd marry me. She said this could never be, for she had got a lover and he was far at sea. She said that she would wait for him. But I'll never forget your kindness in the cottage by the shore, and at each social gathering a flowing glass I'll drain, and I'll drink a health to me Creole girl by the lakes upon the train.
Of Pontchartrain by Paul Brady, the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions, the actor and director Romola Gary. The programme was produced by Claire Walker. And next week, Michael's guest is the writer Colin McCann.
BBC Radio 3, the home of live classical music.
The audience loving this performance, lots of them on their feet.
From unique performances across the UK.
Fantastic, yeah. Absolutely brilliant.
Well, it's spectacular.
To our lunchtime concerts from Wigmore Hall. And marvellous Saturday night opera.
Incredible live music. All year round.
Listen on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
Hello from me, John Shea, and a very happy Easter to you if you're celebrating today. This afternoon, choral evensong for Easter Day is live from Newcastle Cathedral. You can hear that at 3 o'clock. Jazz Record Requests follows at 4, and then the Early Music Show investigates the Brockers Passion, a version of the Passion story written by one Bartold Brockers, which became the text of choice for Handel, Telemann and several of their contemporaries as they composed music for the approach to Easter in early 18th century Germany. Find out more with Hannah French at 5 o'clock this afternoon. But now at 1:30, as part of Radio 3's seasonal journey for Easter, it's time for this week's edition of Music Map with Sarah Moore-Peach.
Hello and welcome to BBC Radio 3's Music Map, the show where we build a web of connections around a single musical endpoint. And today, we're heading for the Vatican and the Sistine Chapel. This choral masterpiece is Allegri's Miserere, and it's the piece we're working our way towards on today's show here on Radio 3. We'll hear the whole thing at the end of our musical journey, and on our way there, we'll touch on music that's in some way related, either because it deals with similar subject matter, or, as in the case of the first few offerings, music connected to a specific building. Gregorio Allegri wrote the Miserere, a setting of Psalm 51, in the 1630s, and it was designed to be performed during Holy Week, the moment before Easter at the far end of Lent, a time in the Christian calendar where sorrow and penitence are at the forefront of the liturgical journey. And it was designed to be performed only in the Vatican's Sistine Chapel. And still today, it's part of that chapel's annual Holy Week tradition. So here's another piece of music to start that's also connected to tradition and a particular building. Written for the coronation of George II in 1727, it's been heard at every British coronation since, in Westminster Abbey.